Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 718.2C1102, certificate number 11658. Lieutenant Nunn.
Sanctuary! Sanctuary!
Sanctuary! Lieutenant Nunn.
Lieutenant Nunn.
Or Lieutenant Nunn in the United Kingdom. Although, Lieutenant Nunn's adventures have not made it to the BBC.
Oh, the one of the few adventures that haven't.
They have all kinds of lieutenants solving village crime, but no Lieutenant Nunn.
Content is king.
Lieutenant Nunn seems like it might be is it an anime? I've seen all 18 seasons of Lieutenant Nunn.
Lieutenant Nunn is definitely like a 70s porno. Like 100% for sure.
Lieutenant Nunn, I need your badge and your gun and your underwear. Lieutenant Nunn is actually both a lieutenant and a nun. Although the lieutenant's a little, an ex-nun at least, and the lieutenant part is a little iffy.
So which is it? She's neither a lieutenant nor a nun, according to your latest
revision. Oh, it's true. Lieutenant Nunn is neither a lieutenant nor a nun. Discuss. She was a nun earlier in her life, but not during most of her adventures. The book she wrote about herself, although its authorship is disputed, it seems to be an autobiography, is called La Monja Alférez.
Okay.
Alférez.
Alférez.
Which means, I guess more literally, it would be like the ensign nun.
Oh.
But it's almost always translated in English. She gets a big promotion. She gets translated in English.
But she's
a
naval officer.
Nun. Yeah, it's a rank. It's a military rank. And her birth name was Catalina de Arauso. And right here, I should say, so much is uncertain about Lieutenant Nunn's life, including her dates. Like, her own account has her born in 1585, while baptismal records have it as 1592. But as we'll see as we look into her life, it's not even clear which pronouns we should use referring to Catalina.
Hmm.
And I mean no offense when I use female pronouns, but that's usually what most academics do because, you know, anything we conclude about her sexuality would be speculative and after the fact. Today, she was...
Nun is kind of a giveaway.
Assigned a woman at birth in the late 16th century. She's a 17th century figure, but she was born around 1590. But in her own writing about herself, she actually will use... She'll have other people refer to her with male pronouns during the part of her life in which she is passing as a man, which is a considerable amount of it.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, we've done episodes of The Omnibus before on women passing as men in military contexts.
Oh, yeah. Who was the figure? I can't remember now.
Yeah, Deborah Sampson, the American Revolutionary War hero.
I remember from, that entry.
From an earlier omnibus.
That was only a year ago, and I have, it's all a blur at this point.
Well, it was COVID year, so right. That year is either no time at all or 10,000 years.
That's right.
But the Lieutenant Nunn had two major careers as a nun and as a lieutenant.
A briefer career as a nun, a longer, the military career is kind of brief too. But in addition to both, she had a series of bizarre, picaresque adventures on several continents, which were immortalized in her own book, which is usually translated as Lieutenant Nun, Memoirs of a Basque Transvestite. Which does not sound like a book from the Spanish Golden Age. Like Memoirs of a Basque Transvestite sounds like a
oh, I know what it sounds
Almodovar like. era memoir.
And so so the titular Lieutenant Nun in this story, in her in their own book, changes pronouns depending on that part of their life.
Yeah, well, she'll have the people referring to her will say him when they, you know, reasonably so when they think.
Because those people would picture them as a him.
I'm not sure if she writes about herself in the third person and uses he in the male parts and she in the female parts, although I guess that would be a possibility as well.
And if this was written in Spanish, it would have been even additionally complexified by the gendered
right there, even language. Nouns are gendered. Yeah. You know, there you can't even say whether someone is your friend or your teacher without saying my male friend, my female friend.
I make sure never to say whether someone is my friend or teacher without specifying their gender in our contemporary times.
Exactly. Do you yeah. say my male teacher, my non-binary teacher?
Yes.
Do you feel like that helps people imagine them?
I do.
Because you can't imagine them. You can't picture them in your head.
I can't picture them. I can only say the words that signify them.
I don't like to reduce people to a gender or even lack thereof.
I like to expand the gender.
I just don't like how you do it with race all the time.
This is my
white friend,
this
Ken.
This is my Basque friend. This is my transvestite friend.
This is my Basque transvestite friend. The book that she ended up writing, these previously mentioned Memoirs of a Basque Transvestite, were not even translated into English until 1908.
What? Where were they moldering for the 200 years prior, 300 years prior?
Well, they had never been translated from the Spanish. The first widespread Spanish publication was in 1829 by Joaquin Maria de Ferrer, who had copied them from another manuscript, which had been copied from an original 1784 that a historian named Munoz had found in the Archive of the Indies, like a New World book library. And all these were, this was a version of what appears to be a quasi-fictional 1626 autobiography, which did make quite a stir when it was released.
Is it possible that it was, that this is some sort of Hitler's Diaries thing where there was no original manuscript?
When you read the book, you cannot help but think that, given the series of bizarre and repetitive and violent and unlikely and melodramatic adventures that Lieutenant Nunn has, on three continents, series of continents, you can't help but wonder, or you can't help but treat it as a novel. And yet, it's told in a very kind of flat, dull affect. Like, and then I fought another duel. You know, the kind of way a fiction writer would never refuse to live in prose, presumably, and where factual, checkable, milestones appear in the work, they do appear to match reality. The dates line up. There are, you know, she is an attested historical figure. You know, her childhood can be shown. The military unit she serves in can be shown. The real people she meets are attested elsewhere, and they appear to be showing up at the right places at the right times.
Interesting.
So from all external evidence, it passes muster as a memoir. It's just the stuff it contains is so crazy that it's hard to believe.
This would have been just at the very dawn of the idea of a novel, though.
So to the degree that that her book made a splash, it was not so much because of the memoir as from the other works it inspired in the popular imagination. There was soon a hit play based on Lieutenant Nunn's adventures. And when someone wrote this time a fully fictionalized, novelized version in 1650, it was believed to this day, it's believed to be the first novel published in the Americas.
Oh.
There was no novel here published before this Lieutenant 1650 Nunn. Fictionalization of Lieutenant Nunn.
I mean, Don Quixote is only 16.
Right.
Five, right?
Same era. This is a very interesting time to be a Spaniard because, you know, it's the golden age of your country's literature and theater and everything. And part of that's because of your country's national prestige on the world stage.
I mean, there's no bad time to be a Spaniard.
I don't know. Franco era is not great.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. Sure. Okay. The exception that proves the rule.
Or is there another bad time to be a Spaniard?
Well, during the Napoleonic era.
Right.
It's not the best time to be a Spaniard.
But
also, if depending on whether or not you were a sailor during the Spanish Armada, that would have been a bad time.
Which Spaniard? This is only 100 years after Columbus. So, you know, Spain is now receiving the glories of New Spain. All their
gold and
conquest and pillage and, you know, genocide, if you want to call it what it is, right. That's going on in the New World at the time. And Catalina de Erauso's memoirs certainly overlap with all of that age of conquest and exploration, including kind of its barbaric and violent spirit. It's everywhere in her work.
They schlep a printing press to the New World, presumably to make Bibles and and pamphlets, but then Lieutenant Nunn somehow makes it.
Look, think who's over there. It's young Spanish soldiers.
Oh, right.
They don't want to read another chapbook of rules. There's Tawana Bibles, I'm sure.
Is it pretty sexy?
It is extremely sexy, but in kind of unexpected forward-thinking ways.
Okay, well, let's hear.
Catalina de Erauso, again, born at the dawn of the 17th century in, as the title of her memoirs reveal, San Sebastian, Spain, in Basque Country. Her dad is a military officer whom she admires, but there are obviously no military options for a young girl in northern Spain in 1600, and in fact, not a lot of options for promising girls anywhere. So she gets the lot of many a bright girl at the time, which is to be shipped off to a Dominican convent, along with her three sisters. Her family sends off.
Oh, gets rid of them all. Doesn't even try and marry them off.
Well, there are reasons to do that back then. It's a real, you know, who has all the power in Spain in 1700? The Catholic Church.
Sure.
So you're showing a lot of loyalty to the most powerful institution of the day by giving your promising youth. That's a favor that the local archbishop will remember.
Yeah.
But it's also a real opportunity for them. Where else are you going to get kids educated? Yes. Where are you going to get young girls educated? There's just not a lot of options.
Right.
Where are they going to learn? You know, in a convent, they're going to have to do, you know, needlepoint and cooking and all the kinds of traditional girly education things. But they're also going to learn to read and write in Latin, which was not going to happen anywhere else. They're going to even learn kind of rudimentary natural science and natural history and astronomy. And, you know, there's a bit of broad liberal education going on in these convents that girls are not getting on the outside in secular settings.
And they're Basque, so they would have been a persecuted minority in Philip's Spain.
I guess. I wonder, I mean, their name is de Erauso, which makes them sound like they are ethnically Basque, and not, she's not just using Basque in the sense of I'm a native of Basque country.
Right.
But her family does seem to be pretty prominent and successful if her dad is a military officer and, you know, and they're making deals with the local Catholic bigwigs to educate the daughters. But, you know, as we will see, Catalina de Erauso is a firecracker. She is a force of nature who cannot be contained. And that includes in the Dominican convent. At the age of 15, she steals
a motorcycle.
She steals a motorcycle and decides to take it all the way down South America.
Mm-hmm.
No, she steals thread and cloth and buttons and whatnot.
Easier to steal than a motorcycle.
It is, because it's smaller. You put it in a pocket or some type of leather bag or jerkin, a tunic.
Yeah.
You slip it into your jute underwear,
yeah,
and you slip out of the convent in the dead of night. And so she runs away at the age of 15 or possibly 12 to 18, depending on which birthday is accurate. And she uses it, she uses it to make herself men's clothing.
Uh-huh. You know, she turns her vestments into some trousers and a jacket.
She does, and decides her name is now, she renames herself Francisco de Loyola. And cuts her hair like a page boy and begins a new life as a disguised man. Later, we'll actually hear that she's... I don't think I don't think they ever bind their chest. They're naturally fairly flat-chested. But in the memoir mentions like herbal remedies that she's taking to that seem to kind of have a hormonal effect on her, making her look more manly. Mm-hmm. People describe a mustache on her later, a thin mustache on her later in life, mm-hmm. Which, you know, happens to all of us, men or women. She doesn't just run away to a forest outside San Sebastian, this being the pinnacle of New Spain, she can really run away someplace good. She runs away to the Caribbean.
Wow, well done.
To Panama and then Peru. She stows aboard. She gets a job as a cabin boy now that she's got her fake short hair and fake trousers.
Actually, probably real short hair and real trousers.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's real short hair and real trousers.
Right. It's a new identity.
It's a disguise.
Yes.
But it's not a wig.
Clever disguise. You know, this was at a time when it was much easier because even in the Caribbean, even when it was 110 degrees, you still would have been expected to wear like a coat and shirt and vests and presumably helmet and gloves.
Yeah. Nowadays, just try to, you know, be on the beach in.
Yeah. How are you going to blend?
In Cuba or Costa Rica and blend in as the opposite sex. Not easy, I'm guessing. But she ends up stealing her. The captain is a family friend or something, or an uncle who lets her on board as a favor.
Oh, and knows it's her.
Apparently. But she repays the favor by stealing all the money out of the cabin and hopping off when they get to Panama.
Oh, come on.
And having adventures. She does not seem to be a nice or admirable person in any way.
I see.
So I'm reluctant to hold her up as any kind of...
unruly teen.
Yeah, or even as any kind of trans hero for our age.
Right. Well, but that's the thing about heroes, right? You can, like, trans culture also needs some baddies.
It's a crueler, yeah, but, you know, we've been making different kinds of LGBT people the villains in our movies for years, you know?
Right, but this is one.
Lesbians with ice picks.
This is a cell phone. This is like a trans bat person.
This is a real one. This is the calls are coming from inside the house. I mean, and it is an era, like I say, it's a more brutal time. You know, it's a time of.
Right.
A time of conquest or whatever. It's not like she's the only conquistador doing mean stuff.
Stealing from your family friend has, I mean, that's got a long tradition in every culture.
Oh, it gets worse. This begins, in her book, just two decades of mostly New World kind of roving, picaresque misadventures.
Banditry and...
Gambling, yeah. Brawling,
okay.
Murder, a ton of womanizing, which we'll get to. It starts very early. There's some kind of altercation with somebody at a theater. You know, another thing about this being New Spain is it's a dueling culture.
All right.
And so a recurring theme in the book is just her getting into all kinds of armed combat with somebody who...
But it's duels with cutlasses, not pistols,
a tall hat
right?
in front of her. Well, in this case, she takes a whetstone. The duel does not come first. Somebody insults her at a theater. She goes and takes a whetstone and uses it to make saw teeth in a dagger. So she is now modding her own weaponry, and then comes back and just gashes the guy and gives him like 10 stitches to the face and neck with her little homemade, home modded dagger.
Right.
At that point, he comes after her with some friends and she kills them all.
Well.
And... Then she does her killer move, and this happens multiple times in the book, and it always works, is she leverages the Catholic Church. Having grown up in a Dominican convent, she knows all the rules and all the loopholes, and she throws herself on the mercy of the church and claims sanctuary, and this happens over and over in the book. She'll get up to, you know, at some point you realize, even in a tough world, if this happens to you over and over, you're the asshole.
Yeah, right. And if you look around and can't find the murderer with the serrated knife in the room. Can't
find the evil mercenary in the room. It's you. It might be you.
So now this throwing oneself upon the mercy of the church, masked gender notwithstanding, can you just go kill people and then go throw yourself on the mercy of the church and be absolved of the civil crime?
It appears yes. And at this point, there is some tension between the power of the church and the power of the state. But she very cleverly leverages that at many points in the book, so that, you know, if civil authorities are after her, she finds out who the religious bigwig in town is and says, you know, Senor, you have to help me. This is unjust. And, you know, find some...
Say the right Catholic thing.
Find some gullible priest and to get out of jail free card, basically, every single time.
Wow.
And I don't think she ever uses her birth assigned gender. You know,
no.
she does not throw herself, you know, instantly become a damsel in distress and then throw herself at the priest's feet.
Because they'd probably burn her at the stake. That would be the worst crime of all.
Well, as we'll see, she later gets an odd amount of indulgence for her cross-dressing.
Interesting.
But that doesn't happen at first. And I think you're right in general. Yeah, this is something she really has to be deep undercover about. Fleeing one of these many civil altercations, which has ended with a bunch of dead Spaniards face down in a dark alley in Peru, she decides to join an army which is being gathered up to head down to Chile and... popular pastime of the era, murder a bunch of Indians.
Mm-hmm,
there's a lot of insurrections going on with the indigenous people. And so there's always three squares a day to be had and good money found fighting Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So under a new male alias, this time Alonso Diaz Ramirez de Guzman, she joins this Chilean army and heads out into the woods and finds, in fact, that the officer who commissions her has a very familiar voice and is surprised to find it's her own brother, Miguel, from back home, who does not recognize her.
Wow.
So this is the kind of thing where you're like, this actually cannot have happened.
Yeah.
And yet, the way the story is told and the way the facts check out, maybe it's embellished, but a lot of this stuff seems to have happened. And so without recognizing her, Miguel dispatches her to fight the Indians, where she becomes a hero.
Wow, she excels at this pursuit, this distinctively Spanish pursuit.
Yes, she becomes a war hero. And at this point, she gets involved in another debauched gambling, probably cheating at cards phase, which ends with a fight, which ends with her fighting a man in a brawl, which again, she never loses a fight in this book.
Uh-huh.
Ends with her almost killing another guy in a brawl. Again, ends up in a Franciscan monastery because she can, if she's passing as male, she can
go to a monastery,
pretend to be a monk in training.
Yeah.
And stays there for 6 months. At this point, another officer asks her to serve as a second in a duel, which is taking place in a dark alleys in some Spanish settlement in Peru. She gets there to serve a second, and, you know, anytime Catalina's on the scene, the fight's going to get bigger, not smaller.
Uh-huh.
She ends up fighting a group of men in the alley when the duel goes wrong, even though she was just supposed to be a second, and ends up killing a man who turns out to be her brother, Miguel.
Oh, no.
The same officer who did not recognize her when he sent her to fight Indians in Chile. And, you know, she heads back to the monastery, which is where they bring the body, and she has to watch her brother laid out.
Did she know it was him when the fight ensued?
Only after the fact.
Oh, no.
So again, the kind of thing you would never believe. Not only is this brother turn up on a different continent, sending her into the army, but he turns out to be the mystery man who she's fighting in a dark alley.
Oh, no.
So, I don't know. Is this stuff embellished? Maybe. I don't know.
Is that what, but does the record show that that's in fact where he died and how?
I think this is accurate. Huh. That Miguel did turn up in Peru later and died in a skirmish.
Because, you know, the Flashman books situate a fictional Lieutenant Flashman in all these historical episodes, where he plays a pivotal role, but it's always very careful.
This is like a British, what is this early 20th century British kind of boys adventure?
Yeah.
It's like, he's like a Zelig or Forrest Gump character.
Who's, yeah. Although not a boys adventure, because they're fairly ribald.
Oh, is that true? It's more pulpy.
Yeah. There's a lot of,
adult stuff.
Yeah. What we would call kissing, in it.
Kids don't want to read about that.
No, you definitely don't want to read about kissing if you are.
What's the name of the author? Is it George MacDonald?
Yeah, Frasier.
Frasier, yes.
And so, but Flashman, you know, Frasier is careful not to have Flashman. He sort of, Flashman single-handedly survives a lot of escapades, but you know, you're not put in the position of needing to go to the record to see if he actually was standing next to, you know, McClellan or whatever at the end of the war. So, but this seems, there's no point at which trying to fact check this story that you come up with, ways that it doesn't work.
Right. And obviously, you know, the records of New Spain in the early 1600s are so fragmentary.
Yeah.
That it would be, you know, it could be pretty embellished and it would be possible to tell. But just kind of the odd, flat, confessional way it's told, it just does make it seem like, hey, my name is Lieutenant Nunn and I've seen some shit.
Right.
At this point, but this does rattle her, realizing that she's killed her brother. So she deserts from the army and with a couple of other deserters kind of heads up north into the Andean highlands, where they promptly get lost. The two men starve to death, and Catalina would as well, except that she's found by a ranch hand and brought down to a settlement and nursed back to health by an indigenous widow who owns this plot. And the widow wants Catalina to marry her daughter. Now, Catalina is...
So in nursing Catalina back to health, the widow never
actually... discovers her, apparently. Yeah. I mean, I guess she's got to be good at deflecting at this point.
Right.
Now, she's had her own memoirs are full of confessions that really make it clear that she likes women a lot. She's always causing little intrigues. At the age of 18, she's romancing her boss's mistress and causing a duel there. There's some point in Lima where she appears to be very attracted to her boss's sister-in-law. She's always combing her hair and running her hands up and down her legs, which gets her, you know, the kind of thing you don't want to do to your boss's sister-in-law. Gets her fired. Later in the book, at one point, she's engaged to two women at the same time. And at this point, she is not attracted to the daughter, but thinks, I got to lay low for a while. So she agrees to the marriage. This is the second simultaneous engagement, because while engaged to the widow's daughter, she's also romancing the daughter of a local Spanish official. So she's got two fiancés. Before either marriage can take place, she manages to steal both dowries and leave town.
Yeah.
That's how to do it.
That is how to do it. I'm going to start writing some of this stuff down.
At this point, she pretty much becomes a full-time con man and brigand on the run from the law, you know, fighting a series of glamorous sword fights on every few pages. This is the bulk of the autobiography and is really the hardest part to pin down. You know, this is the part where there could be a lot more embellishment.
The sword fight portion.
Yeah, but it's also repetitive. You know, there's not a whole lot of plot turns. It's really a lot of, and then I got to this city, and then I soon got into a fight, and then I was almost on the point of being arrested and had to run to the cathedral. And, you know, this just happens time and time again. It happens in La Paz, where she's arrested and has to use the church again. They want to hang her.
Yeah.
And she has to, again, play the local law enforcement against the local monastery.
Was Catalina a drinker?
Must have been. Although it doesn't appear in the work, but I assume that's just because you would not have to mention it in the early...
Right.
1600s that you were drinking heavily in the Spanish army, because everyone was. I don't know. Am I right?
Yeah. Am I right?
She winds up in 17th century Spaniards. Am I right? Glug, glug, glug. She winds up in Cuzco, where she finds a rival gang leader, kind of another brigand called El Cid, like the new Cid, not the fighting Spanish hero, but named in honor of, I guess in the same way that a French gangster might be called Little Napoleon or whatever. This guy's the new Cid, who tries to take some of her winnings. He tries to, what do you call it? Rake off some of her winnings every time she hits it big at cards, which keeps happening. She never says she's cheating in the memoir, but you kind of have to assume. And he keeps doing it. And finally, the third time he reaches for her stack, she just puts a dagger through his hand on the table. As you can imagine, the gambling den does not take too quietly to this. She's too kindly to this. She's kicked out. The gang follows. Even though El Cid is armored and Catalina is not, she takes him down and kills this infamous local rogue. But she is also mortally wounded.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, last rites are even said over her. She confesses to a local priest, and this time she tells the whole story, including the convent, all her crimes. The priest is shocked, but can't say anything because these are last rites. But of course she survives. And now that she's confessed her whole story to a priest and, you know, and killed a pretty big name in the local underworld, it's getting harder and harder to stay under the radar. Posses are being organized. Everywhere she goes, she'll get recognized because there are now posters up.
Yeah.
Have you seen this man? And finally, in the city of Guamanga, she is she's escapes arrest in Ayacucho, finds sanctuary with the bishop, and then confesses to the bishop the whole story. You know, I'm a woman. I'm a daughter of such and such a man, a woman. I was grown up here. Instead of taking my vows at the convent, I ran off, blah, blah, blah. I have roamed, hustled, corrupted, maimed, and murdered until I have come to end up here at his lordship's feet. Now, the bishop is shocked. I'm sure he's seen a lot of bad behavior.
Sure.
In this frontier town.
Right. Goes with the territory.
I always say frontier in Spanish.
Frontier.
It's only a frontier in America. It's the frontera here in Ayacucho or Guamanga or wherever we are. And he doesn't believe the story. So he has some midwives examine her. And they confess that, yes, she is anatomically a woman. And more to the point, and this seems to be what impresses the priest, her virginity is intact.
Huh.
Now, this is a big deal back then, because really, how bad could she be?
If she's still a virgin.
You know, the conception back then of a sinful woman would be sexual debauchery. You know, right. That's what obsesses all these creepy guys, right?
Sure. You can murder 50 people, but if you're a virgin, you're still pure.
How bad can she be?
If you had kissed a couple of soldiers, you'd be consigned to eternity in hell.
You're right. There does seem to be something about the fact that back then women's sins would be lust. These are the kind of sins that women feel and guide men into.
Right.
Surely a man who's been having an affair has been seduced into it by this lustful woman. Only men have these sins of violence. So the fact that she, A, turns out to be a woman, that would confine her sins to the traditional women's ones, and her physical intactness means that she's not succumbed to any of them. Because back then, it wouldn't have occurred to the priest, oh no, she's just like super duper lesbian.
Right.
Or, you know, today—
lesbian warrior.
Or today we would say, we would admit the possibility that she's not a lesbian, she's a trans man. But the priest is very impressed that she's managed to keep her virtue intact. And the fact that she's been sawing through people's necks with home-modified daggers doesn't seem to bother him. So he decides to, you know, Catalina, you've run away from the convent. We can fix this. Let's put you in a nun's habit. And he sends her off to the convent. And word from Spain is consulted as to whether or not she's actually taken vows. And when she has not, she's essentially imprisoned in the convent. Like, this was part of her conditions of her parole, essentially, is that she has to be a nun. But when word comes back that she's not a nun, that she was just a young teen in a convent, a novice or whatever, she's allowed to go. And at this point, she makes her way back to Spain. And I guess word of her unlikely gender-bending adventures have reached Spain ahead of her, have preceded her. And so she's a real novelty. You know, she's greeted like a hero when she gets to Cádiz. And this is where the most interesting part of the story happens, because she requests an audience with King Philip to say, hey, I served in your army fighting the whatever Mapuche Indians or whatever, and I don't have a pension. And she manages to talk the king into granting her 800 escudos a year.
Wow.
Even though she seems to be not just what would be regarded as a deviant at the time, but really one of the worst cutthroats of the age.
Yeah.
By her own confession. So,
but her book has not been published at this point. Her story has not been told in Catalina's own words.
She appears to dictate it around this time. It's probably during her visit to Europe where her story starts capturing people's imaginations that she sits down a scribe, and unless the whole book is a later fabrication,
right,
which doesn't seem impossible. It would have been during this European trip where she dictates it. And, you know, the fact that she's able to wheedle this out of the king, despite all she's done, I mean, it, for one thing, it just reveals kind of what a cruel and brutal age this is. But also, it just shows whatever her other attributes, you know, there's a reason why she keeps getting out of trouble. You know, she's a survivor.
She's a smooth operator.
Yeah, she knows what to say and who to say it to and how to butter them up. And I guess, you know, if maybe a modern diagnosis would say she's borderline or sociopathic or whatever, but I mean, that kind of ability to operate sometimes comes with that kind of personality just because it's a survival mechanism.
All great progress is made by sociopaths. I mean, the rest of us are just trailing along.
You've worked in rock music. Oh. You've seen some of these smooth characters.
Oh, boy.
In fact, there's a surviving picture of her, and I don't know how accurate this oil painting is, but she really does look like a British invasion musician. She's kind of got the... Who does she look like? Ronnie Wood, maybe?
Yeah, she does. She looks like one of the small faces.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because she's got a big face.
Yeah.
The small faces of the ironically named British invasion band. She actually kind of has a Rod Stewart look. It's like all the small faces together, right?
Yeah. In one big
small face.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She could start a group called the One Faces.
She's got the haircut that they wish they had.
Yeah, she's in painting. She does kind of have the Prince Valiant page boy but kind of the home cut COVID version of the page boy.
Yeah, right.
That you could imagine seeing on one of these musicians. Mm-hmm. Anyway, her even more impressive feat from her European trip is a trip to Rome, where she requests an audience from Urban VIII, the Pope.
Is she well enough known that this trip to Rome is a is like an all expenses paid junket, or is she hopping freights to Rome?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, she's got her 800 escudo a year pension.
She's got in order to request an audience, you have to.
I don't think this is like Elizabeth I wanting to meet Pocahontas. I don't think Urban VIII was like, bring me this odd, sexually ambiguous young person.
Right.
I think it's more like she headed to Rome and asked for an audience. And her request, according to her autobiography, and this there's no Vatican record of, but her autobiography suggests that she sought from him a special dispensation to keep dressing like a man, which would have been a religious prohibition at the time, right? On the basis of scriptural interpretation about what men and women should wear and do with their hair.
Right.
You know, they would have had predictably Inquisition era views about social mores.
Right.
They're not an open-minded people.
Not at the time.
The Spanish Catholics of the era.
But she's going to the Italian Catholics. So,
that's right. You know, as we know from other omnibi, you know, there's a lot more free thinking going on in the whatever, what's the name of the Pope's summer palace? There's hanky-panky going on. And according to her memoir, he agrees that, you know, she's been such a staunch defender of the faith. Because, you know, she plays herself up as a military hero in the New World.
Oh, right.
Protecting the church and the crown against all these forces of heathen barbarism.
Including her brother, the assistant governor.
I think she leaves that out.
Yeah,
it's more like these Indians were desecrating a Bible, your holiness. And
luckily, I had to take on the clothes of a man.
Luckily, I was there. And in her memoir, the Pope agrees that she will be able to continue her life dressing as Francisco or Alonso or whatever her current... nom de conquistador is.
No, I did not see that coming, I have to say. generally popes, in my experience, tend to be not really, you know, like malleable on questions of this kind of thing, right? They're not like, you know what, you make a good point. Like popes don't typically say things like that. They kind of, it's a hierarchical society.
This must be a sign of her, again, another sign of her. Mm-hmm. Just
she's good at fast talker.
Yep. Stubborn about what she wants and
convincing.
A convincing diplomat and a shrewd negotiator.
It's possible that there might have been a serrated knife involved in the negotiations.
Right. She doesn't confess to any kind of...
hello to my little friend.
In her version, Urban is just fascinated with her.
Right.
You know, because she's such a novelty. At this point, and you know, this is when the portrait gets painted and she looks a little bit like Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood had a kid. And she heads back to the New World, this time winding up in Mexico.
Oh, back to the New World again.
Mm-hmm. And this is where she spends the last 20... And her at this point, her memoir has been dictated and her... portrait's been painted and she's met all her famous people. And so this is where kind of her public mythologizing of herself ends. And you know, in the historical accounts, she appears to have lived a pretty quiet life after this.
Huh.
And maybe that's just because she's no longer around to make her own story sound more dashing and full of daring do.
Mm-hmm.
And an edgy Tarantino-esque violence.
Uh-huh.
But in the historical record, she's back in Mexico. She runs a mule train between Mexico City and Veracruz and spends the last 20 years of her life pretty quietly. There's one more kind of womanizing intrigue. On her way back, because she'd been hired to be the bodyguard of a girl who was being sent back to Mexico to be married, Catalina falls in love with this girl who is already engaged to an Hidalgo, to a Mexican bigwig.
If you're picking a bodyguard for your you know, vulnerable new bride, maybe not the womanizingest lesbian in the era.
Do you think it's just utter naivete that that's even an option? Because, you know, even today reading her book, she never says, oh, and I was a huge lesbian. You know, you're just kind of reading between the lines about all these intrigues that arise in connection with all these women.
Yeah, you could
fiancés
see,
and in-laws.
You could see the people of the time, the men of the time making the category error of thinking, oh, my young bride will be safe with Catalina because... I mean, she's a woman. So yeah. How can
of all the tough people I could put her with?
Yeah,
I'll just put her with a fellow woman because then what could happen?
What could possibly happen?
Just this, you know. I'll just put her with this big butchy woman with a forceful personality and a little mustache.
Uh-huh.
And so predictably, this winds up in another one of Catalina's many duels over a woman.
There's a fight.
Yes, but that's kind of the end of her. The rest of her life is she's a dull muleteer, living quietly, you know, dressed as a man, which is a novelty. So, you know, so she continues to appear in the Mexican record.
She's dressed as a man, but everybody knows the truth.
Yeah, and that's just, she's a local, maybe not a local celebrity, but like a, you know, a novelty, a character.
Sure, I see.
Part of the weird cultural fabric of this part of New Spain. And she dies at 1650.
At the age of?
Depending on which account you believe, she's either 65 or 58.
A long life.
For back then, not so bad. Especially considering, you know, per number of duels fought, it might be the the longest life of anyone at the time. And that's really how you should do it.
Right, right.
You just divide your lifespan by number of duels fought, and she might have the highest ratio of anybody, man or woman, in New Spain.
And that concludes Lieutenant Nunn, entry 718.2C1102. Certificate number 11658 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. You can find Ken Jennings on the internet at Ken Jennings, and you can search for me on the internet. And good luck to you, my friends.
Will you be under a series
of... John Roderick.
Under a series of pseudonyms? Francisco de Loyola?
Yeah, that's right.
That's actually a good Jesuit pseudonym for
that
you.
That would be a pretty good pseudonym. You can find me at patreon.com/John Roderick, but that's the only place. Also, you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Ken or Ken's wife, Mindy, will read the email. And if you mention me specifically by name, there is a 20% chance that that Ken or Mindy will forward the email.
I feel like Mindy doesn't read the email unless it's like it's not a bookkeeping complaint type Patreon stuff.
So it's you. It's you that decides whether or not I'm going to read the emails. Oh, I guess it's me that decides by not reading them, but it's you that decides the ones that you want to earmark.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm 100% effective at people being like, hey, John, well, I mean, if they're just like, love the show, I'm not going to be like, well, John does the show. I should send this to him.
Hmm.
But when people have a question,
All right.
I send it to you.
You can support our program at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We are a listener-supported show, and we appreciate your financial support. We also your moral support and your spiritual support. You can mail us actual physical items at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. Ken, it looks like you've got a mailbag open over there.
Yeah, E. Jordan of Seattle has sent us some ephemera, just random old-timey stuff. People just send us garbage now.
I love it.
And it's fantastic, because this is actually really good stuff. One is from the Office of Civil Defense of the State of California in 1950. From no less than Governor Earl Warren, not yet Chief Justice Warren.
Chief Justice Warren. I believe I have that pamphlet already.
Survival Under Atomic Attack. Mm-hmm. Where is the best place to go?
How many layers of tinfoil should I put under my baseball hat to protect me from gamma rays?
There is little you can do to protect your house from blast. Oh, man.
You can build a bomb shelter like the one we're in.
I thought if I had like double pane windows or whatever, I could stand up to an atomic explosion. Mm-hmm. It is best to figure on collapse of the upper floors and to take cover in the cellar.
Yes. Figure on it.
Kill the myths. Atomic weapons will not destroy the earth.
Well.
Thanks, Governor Warren. Atomic bombs hold more death and destruction than man ever before has wrapped up in a single passage, but their overall power still has very definite limits. Oh, thanks. I feel better.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Radioactivity is not the bomb's greatest threat.
Really?
Really?
What is the bomb's greatest threat? Hurt feelings?
Use the telephone only for true emergencies. That's what I always do in a nuclear war.
That's my general policy with telephones. Only true emergencies. Don't call me trying to schedule something.
Water in your pipes of your house at the time of explosion will not be radioactive.
All right.
I don't know if I believe any of this, honestly.
Well, it's protected by lead, because all the pipes would have been lead then.
That's true. You'll get a different kind of poisoning. Here's the Leslie method of R movement writing, which is a cursive writing.
Well, that's a nice little book. I like the typeface.
It's full of a few dozen, 100 exercises to master the Leslie style of writing. You should check this stuff out.
Thank you.
What else do we have? It looks like a mini comic called Moose Number 9 with some super R-crumb influenced big-bottomed, borderline racially offensive ladies.
Moose Number 9. Let me see. Maybe I'll recognize the...
I don't know if it's a local...
rip-off press artist. Oh, it's like a little zine.
Yeah. Here's another mini comic zine. This one's quite comely. The Sacrifice. Bomb Time for Bonzo Number 1. Three different artists are publishing in this one.
Oh, this is super-duper zine-y. But this isn't from the 60s. This is...
No. But you can see on the first leaf, you can see the R-crumb influenced.
Yeah, I do. Well, this is a recent
vintage. Here are two postcards so old that postcard is two words. Would you like a postcard? One is the battleship Alabama. One is the cruiser Tennessee. It's from Britton and Ray, lithographers, San Francisco. These are early 20th century. That's very cool. Here's a little sign language alphabet to carry with you at all times so you can fingerspell.
Uh-huh.
That's helpful.
Oh, that's very helpful.
Here's a guide to the birth and growth of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific.
mean, all of this taken together is, I'm
learning a lot about E. Jordan.
Yeah, E. Jordan really has a sense of what Omnibus is.
I love the apostrophe, its birth and growth. See, some things predate the internet. And finally, a Mars Attacks card. Not one of the old ones. This appears to be from the era of the Tim Burton movie. But it's got Wally Wood art. This is not Wally Wood on the front. This looks like Keith Giffen on the front. The back is a Wally Wood sketch. Thank you so much, E. Jordan.
Thanks, E.
If you go to the Patreon, you can see... donors, supporters can see images of all this stuff if you're curious.
I love that inland boatman is one word on this pamphlet.
Yeah, postcard two words in the olden days, but inland boatman.
Inland Boatman's Union.
I don't think I would ever be like part of any term. Organization that would have a 13-letter job in the title or me as a member.
Did you just know that it had 13 letters by some kind of strange mind?
Yeah, training? I'm pretty good at that.
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Wow. In this case, you can just do inland and boatman.
Yeah, but I wouldn't instantly know the number of letters in either of those words.
I can just by
inland.
I can do up to 8 just looking at a word.
Boatman.
After 9, 10, 11, it gets a little.
I guess it's a skill that it never occurred to me to try and practice.
It's a kind of synesthesia where the word just seems different to me. Like a 6-letter word just seems incredibly different. But it's probably just from a lifetime of being a dork and doing like crosswords.
Interesting. You just looked at inland boatman and your first thought was 13 letters.
It comes up on Jeopardy a lot. The category will be 13-letter words. And you don't want to have to sit there counting on your fingers because you'll look like a dumb Kevin on TV.
One more way in which Ken Jennings' mind defies convention.
I feel like if I'd lived in the 17th century, I could have just wrecked a swath of violence and plunder across South America with talents like that.
Hmm.
But different time.
Time is a flat circle.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. If everything goes wrong soon, just remember, drink all the water in the pipes. It's fine.
That's right.
The gamma rays can't get in there. And in fact, we hope and pray that the catastrophe will never come. But if the worst comes soon, head to your cellar. This recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.